This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, and I'm Joe Palca, sitting in for Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, we'll take a look at a new drug that offers hope for leukemia patients resistant to the cancer drug Gleevec, but first, HIV and AIDS. An estimated 20,000 scientists, activists, policymakers, and AIDS-infected people gathered in Bangkok, Thailand this week to assess the progress, or lack of progress, in fighting the disease. They were also there to plan new strategies and to share information on the latest advances in treatment and prevention. Today is the last day of the meeting, but before the participants head home, we'll get a roundup of the week's events. Joining me now from Bangkok to give us an update on the meeting is NPR correspondent Richard Knox. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me today, Richard. I guess it's kind of late at night there, huh?
Oh, it's Saturday morning here after a little after 1 o'clock.
Okay, well we'll call it Friday for our purposes. I'd like to invite listeners, if they'd like to join the conversation, to give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And if you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. So, Dick, what were some of the major themes that emerged from this year's meeting?
Well, the overarching theme really is a new one for this meeting. This is the 15th in a series that really began in 1985. And the new problem is how to spend a lot of new money. In the past, the issue was whether it was going to be possible to provide HIV treatment to people in poor countries. Now the issue is how to do it and how soon it can be done. There's been a tenfold increase in money for AIDS over the past 6 or 7 years, so this has been mounting, and so far very little has actually shown up in AIDS treatment on the ground or in new prevention programs. But since the last AIDS meeting in Barcelona 2 years ago, there's just been an enormous amount of new money, at least pledged, something like $20 billion, I'm told.
Wow.
And so now people are trying to figure out how to usefully spend it.
Well, I guess one of the areas that that money has been available for, although exactly how it to be spent must still be an issue, and that's about prevention. And I gather this meeting has seen quite a debate about the conflict, or if it is a conflict, between abstinence and condom use as a prevention strategy for AIDS.
Yeah, it's a continuing debate. I think that this meeting went a little beyond what the debate has been up to now, and that's probably a good thing. It's more complicated than it has often been portrayed. Basically, the outline is that it's between ABC, which is the approach that favors abstinence for people who are not in committed sexual relationships. B is for be faithful if you are in a committed relationship, and C is use condoms if you can't do the A or B, or if you're in a high risk situation such as a commercial sex worker or a client. And that is the other side is basically relying much more on condoms and so-called harm reduction, such as clean needles for people who are injecting drug users. So, you know, that's been the kind of dichotomy. I think there was a lot more subtlety in the debate. And, you know, for instance, Uganda has been sort of the exhibit A in the Bush administration's ABC policy, which is the way they'd like to see much of the new money spent. And President Museveni of Uganda spoke eloquently about Uganda's policy. But if you listen closely to Museveni, if you talk to some of the other Ugandans who came to the Bangkok meeting, you heard that Uganda really does rely on all three, and including condoms, and not just for high-risk people such as sex workers. One they told me that, you know, condoms are a mainstay of the program because, you know, you can delay sexual debut, as many Ugandans are, and still be infected on your first sexual encounter. And wives can be faithful and still get infected by their husbands. I think the really interesting thing is that there's a new appreciation here about the vulnerability of women being infected, and most new infections are women. even if they are faithful, because they don't know that their husbands are going to be faithful, and they can't, many of them around the world can't really ask, much less insist, that their husbands use a condom without risking abuse.
Right.
So there are limits to the condom approach as well.
Yep. It sounds like it's just one of those intractable problems. Dick, I have to say that your telephone line is breaking up a bit, so I'm going to wrap it up there, and thank you very much for staying up to talk to us, but appreciate your reporting. It's really been excellent this week.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I'll talk to you again. We'll look forward to seeing you back in America. That was NPR's science correspondent, Richard Knox. And now I'd like to introduce my guests for the rest of this segment on AIDS. First, let me introduce Gary Nabel. He's the director of the Vaccine Research Center at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. That's part of the National Institutes of Health. He joins us by phone from Bethesda, Maryland. Thanks for talking with us, Dr. Nabel.
Hi, John.
And on the phone also from Bangkok, Thailand, is Paul A. Volberding. He's a professor and vice chair of the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. He's also director of the Center for AIDS Research at UCSF and the chief of medical services at the San Francisco Veterans Affairs Medical Center. And Dr. Volberding, I thank you for staying up so late, and it's nice to talk to you.
That's great, and I hope my phone connection is better than the other one.
Well, I hope so. I'll let you know. Anyway, if you'd like to join the conversation, again, our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And I'd like to ask you, Dr. Volberding, one of the critiques of this meeting in Bangkok was there just wasn't a lot of science, new science about AIDS. And I'm wondering if that's because scientists chose not to bring their information to this meeting and save it for more specialty meetings, or because there's not a lot of new information to report.
Well, we've made a huge investment in HIV science, and there's a lot to talk about. But I think it's true that scientists consider some of the other smaller meetings where there's more of a chance for a smaller group discussion to be a favored place to present a lot of new science. This is a meeting where it's turning into a very important conference where implementation of science is the real focus. As Richard was saying, how do we take the information and the money we now have and really get them to the people that need them the most?
Dr. Volberding, we are having the same kind of a problem with your phone line. We'll talk to you, I think, first for as long as we can, and then if it becomes unusable, we'll just say goodbye, if that's all right.
Okay, it sounds fine from this end. But,
yeah, I know. There's something.
I understand. It
may be sunspots. I don't know, but something's interfering. I was going to ask you, picking up from where we were talking, Dick Knox and I, about prevention. I gather that some of the interesting information out of this meeting dealt with the search for better spermicides and preventions that wouldn't involve a condom but might be used as to protect yourself during sex.
Exactly. The term microbicide is used, and that's seen as a very important issue, a prevention that a woman can use even perhaps without her partner's knowledge or consent. A very important strategy for HIV and potentially for other sexually transmitted infections as well.
And do those appear to be imminent?
No, unfortunately, the development of those is still years away, but there is at least a growing interest and an appreciation that they are important, and the hope that that will translate into more research.
Okay, Dr. Volberding, I think maybe we're just going to have to end it there because your line has dropped out one more time. So I guess we'll say thank you very much for joining us, and we'll focus the rest of our discussion on our American colleague, who Gary Nabel. I hope you're prepared to pick up some heavy lifting here.
I'll do what I can.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Volberding,
okay,
for joining
bye-bye.
Us. Dr. Paul Volberding is professor and vice chair of the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and he was nice enough to stay up until the middle of the night to talk to us, and we've been defeated by technology, but such is life. So, Dr. Nabel, we're going to have to take a break in just a second, but briefly, we're going to talk with you about vaccines. Was there any really interesting vaccine information to come out of this meeting?
I don't think there's anything that was presented at the meeting that we didn't know already, but clearly there are a number of advances in the field and products that are moving forward into trials, and we can talk about the status of those.
Actually, we do have a bit more time. I've misread my clock trying to keep track of time in Thailand, I guess. So what are the vaccines that are the most mature in terms of their development at this point?
Well, you know, there has really only been to date one efficacy trial for an HIV vaccine. This was the AIDSvax protein product that was made by Vaxgen. As you're probably well aware, that vaccine showed no efficacy in protecting against HIV infection. There are currently a second generation of vectors that are being tested, or vaccines that are being tested. They fall into the category of what I would call more sophisticated vaccines, using newer technology and using what we would call vectored approaches. That is, we modify viruses that would otherwise cause infection, and we engineer them to express bits and pieces of HIV in the hope of stimulating immune responses to those parts of the virus, but not causing disease. There's currently one trial ongoing in Thailand of a canarypox variant together with with or without a protein boost. And then there are a whole series of newer vectors that are being tested in earlier stages that involve the use of DNA vaccines, modified adenoviruses. And those are the ones that I think are showing promising results, at least in animal models, and most of the field has their eye on those.
I see. Are any of these gene-based vaccines in clinical trials now?
Yes, a number of them are, and I expect that what you'll see is that within the next year or two, you'll see them advance to the stage of what we would call an efficacy trial, or at least what we call a proof-of-concept efficacy trial. There is one that's being developed by Merck, which involves an adenoviral vector that expresses three of the HIV gene products. And there's another one from our center, from the Vaccine Research Center, that is a combination of the gene-based DNA vaccines together with an adenovirus boost. And both of those are moving forward. Both have progressed through phase one or are in various stages of analysis in phase one. And those are the ones that I think will be the next wave to be tested.
Just to quickly to explain, what is a phase one trial?
Well, phase one in terms of a vaccine development plan is the equivalent of sticking your toe in the water. We start by giving small amounts of the vaccine product to a limited number of vaccine participants, and then we increase the dose of that vaccine, and we make sure that there are no adverse responses to the vaccine, and we also make sure that the vaccine's inducing the kinds of immune responses that we would expect it to induce. Once we have reached the dose that we think would be optimal, assuming it doesn't have any side effects, we then go into expanded safety testing, which is what we call phase two. After the expanded safety testing, we would then proceed into the kinds of efficacy studies where we would actually look in large numbers of individuals to see whether the vaccine prevents infection.
Okay. We're going to have to take a short break here. We're talking this hour about AIDS and the AIDS prevention and AIDS prevention using vaccines and other methods. Stay with us. We're going to be taking your calls at 1-800-989-8255. We'll be right back. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Joe Palca. We're talking this hour about the AIDS pandemic. My guests this hour are Gary Nabel, director of the Vaccine Research Center at the National Institutes of Health. And after a brief hiatus, we've managed to reestablish contact with Dr. Paul Volberding, who's the director of the Center for AIDS Research at UCSF and the chief of medical services at the San Francisco Veterans Affairs Medical Center. And he was on the phone from Thailand when we had some phone difficulties. But I think you're back now. Is that right, Dr. Volberding?
I am, Joe. Thanks. And just to correct something, I'm the co-director, along with Warner Green, my very esteemed colleague in San Francisco at the Center for AIDS Research.
I would hate to have to explain to him why I left him out, so I'm glad you brought it up. Since we've got you back and since we haven't had our listeners join the conversation, let me take a call from, how about Marissa in San Diego? Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very much. I'm concerned about the current lack of research in the benefits of breastfeeding and how milk might be treated, human milk might be treated, so that babies in at-risk populations are able to still have the benefits without being exposed to the additional risks of formula in those third world countries, where women have a habit of trying to water it down and do all sorts of things, which end up endangering the baby's health even further.
Interesting question, Marissa. Dr. Volberding, did that come up at all at this meeting, or do you have any perspective on that?
Well, it did actually, somewhat indirectly, but I think the answer is actually very easy. If the woman is infected and is taking effective anti-HIV medicines, then the risk of breastfeeding should be dramatically reduced. So again, if we can suppress the virus in the woman, then the risk of transmission to the baby should be very, very close to zero.
Okay, Marissa, thanks for the call. Let's go to John in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Yes, I have a question. I was actually part of a research clinical trial about 10 or 12 years ago that studied what they called an immunomodulator, which was a drug that was actually quite well known at the time, FK-565. From the Fujisawa Drug Company, and they were trying this drug in a phase one trial in HIV patients. And long story short, they stopped the trial because cancer patients that were given the same drug were having adverse reaction. But I was wondering if any of your panel has ever heard of the drug, because the HIV patients demonstrated a complete drop in viral load as a result of this immunomodulator, which I believe sort of acts the same way that I believe vaccines are designed to work.
Interesting, John. Let me put that question to Dr. Volberding. Do you know about this particular compound?
I don't know the compound per se. I know that there has been and remains a lot of interest in immune modulators in HIV, but I'm not aware of any that have by themselves had much of an effect on the virus. I think we can do so well by directly inhibiting the virus that's where the focus really has been in the last 5, 10, 15 years.
Dr. Nabel, ring any bells with you?
Not this specific drug, no. I should say, though, that another area of investigation that stems from vaccine research is the whole idea of testing what we call therapeutic vaccines. And that would be in individuals who might already be infected. If we can suppress the virus load, we are looking at a number of vaccine candidates for their ability to stimulate the immune system as well. So far, there aren't any major hits there, but it is certainly an area of active investigation.
Huh. Thanks for the call, John. Dr. Volberding, I'm wondering, there was a paper last week about a new kind of drug called an integrase inhibitor, I guess. Did that get any attention at this meeting?
It was one of the drugs, one of the new targets that was actively discussed. Not a lot of new information presented at this meeting on the integrase inhibitor, but that hit new targets in the HIV life cycle for patients whose virus is already lots of interest in new drugs.
This is funny, Dr. Volberding. I'm really sorry, but the line is going bad again. So I think this time we'll wish you a very good night, and thank you for staying up. And I appreciate your good humor in staying with us during this little technical
happy
thing.
To,
okay.
Happy to try.
Catch you again sometime. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Good enough, Jim.
Thanks. Bye-bye. So now the rest of this segment on AIDS, we'll talk about vaccines. Let me ask Dr. Nabel first. There's a lot of trials going on. You mentioned there were several efficacy trials, several phase one safety trials, phase two expanded safety trials. I mean, how do you find the people to take part in these trials? There's a lot of, there's a lot of people with AIDS, but it's who's the right people to test? Are you getting all the volunteers you need?
Well, you've raised really a very critical question, Joe. I think that no matter how much work we do in the laboratory to identify new vaccine candidates and how much testing we do in animals, we can never know whether a vaccine will protect against HIV infection until we do trials in people. And so those phase one and phase two trials that that you were mentioning really require that we do testing in normal, uninfected human volunteers. And so in a way, that's quite a large number of people that we need to reach out to help us to find a solution to this very difficult problem. Just to give you an example, even the smaller proof of concept efficacy studies will ultimately involve probably about 10 to 15,000
wow.
people per trial. And so, as we're doing our initial studies now, our phase one, phase two studies here at the Vaccine Research Center, we are vitally dependent on volunteers, and to the extent that any of your listeners would be interested in participating and helping to provide a solution to this problem, we would love to have them step forward and help us with that effort.
I presume there's some sort of a website or 800 number or something like that?
Yes, our website at the VRC is just www.vrc.nih.gov. And we have a phone number, 866-833-LIFE.
Okay. I'd like to go to the phones again and take a call from Michael in San Diego, California. Welcome to Science Friday, Michael.
Hi, how you guys doing? I'm wondering about some things. If there was anything on the dissident side of the issue coming out of Bangkok, especially since Carrie Mullis, who discovered the PCR test, had stated that the test was not able to actually count HIV particles?
Michael, we had Dr. Paul Volberding on the line from Bangkok, but unfortunately technical problems forced us to sign off with him, and I don't think we can make Dr. Nabel answer that question, so thanks for your call. Let's try, is it Chris in Moose Lake, Minnesota? Is that right? Did I get that right?
Yes, thank you.
Welcome to the Science Friday. What's your question?
I understand HIV has different strains that are labeled by letter A through E, and that those infect different areas of the world. I was wondering if the vaccines are intended to be equally efficacious for each of those strains.
Interesting question, Dr. Nabel.
Well, you've hit on a point that's very near and dear to us here at the VRC. You're absolutely right that the predominant clade of virus, that's another word for strain, that we see in the United States and Europe is what we call clade B. But the most prevalent strains are those that we find in Africa, and they would include what we call clades A and C. The vaccine prototype that we're moving forward from our center actually includes a component of the envelope, one component from clade A, one from B, and one from C. And so we are attempting to address the diversity issue in terms of the strains that we see around the world. Having said that, we also have to recognize that there's even more heterogeneity within each of these classes, that within the A, B, and C category, there are even further subdivisions. So we really, at the research side, have to dig into the meaning of that diversity. Is there an impact on vaccine efficacy within the subclades of each clade? We hope not, because obviously if it becomes too specific, then it really reduces our chances of having a broadly effective vaccine. This, again, is what some of the human trials will tell us.
Chris, thanks very much for your call.
Thank you.
I'm just wondering, you know, maybe I have to ask the sort of the simple-minded question, but why has it been so darn hard to find an effective vaccine? Well, why is you guys know a lot about the virus and you know a lot about, what it does. Why is it so hard with this particular disease I suppose it's ever easy, but this one seems to be particularly difficult.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Joe. The AIDS virus is probably one of the most daunting targets that one could pick to develop a vaccine against. If you look at the virus, there are really probably two reasons why we have the difficulties that we have. First, this is a virus that shows unprecedented genetic variability. So just to give you an example, if you were to look at the number of different strains of influenza that you would find circulating in the world in a flu outbreak in a year, you would actually see fewer flu viruses worldwide in one year than you would see in a single individual infected with HIV. So that means that we don't have a constant target. It means that every virus literally that's in each person differs in some small way or some large way from the virus of another person infected. The other problem with the virus is that it really has evolved to escape immune detection. So the structure of the virus is one where it essentially can hide from the immune system. And it hides either by covering the outside part of the virus with different types of sugar molecules or by actually constantly changing the protein coat on the virus, the envelope, so that it's never fixed in one position. And it's really this combination of the genetic variability and the cloaking that the virus uses to hide from the immune system that makes it so difficult.
We're talking with Dr. Gary Nabel at the National Institutes of Health Vaccine Research Center about AIDS vaccines, and you're welcome to join the conversation. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. And let's go to Sally in Rochester, New York. Sally, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Joe. I just wanted to make a comment about the volunteers for vaccine trials. I'm a vaccine volunteer from, it's got to be at least 12 years ago. For the canary pox version of GP160 vaccine. These vaccine trials ensure the safety as much as possible of these volunteers. There's no way we're being infected by participating in these trials. It's safe, and it's worthwhile, and it's a noble thing to do, and I just want to encourage people to think about this population and our world at large and try to put themselves into a trial if they live near a vaccine center. I also work for an institution that participates in these trials.
Well,
so I just really want to encourage people to not be so, you know, people hear that word and run for cover, and it just isn't the reality of these trials.
Well, that's an interesting point, and maybe I can turn to Dr. Nabel and say, well, first of all, do people have any reason to be afraid to begin with? And second of all, why would you want to test this in healthy volunteers instead of starting it in people who already have HIV infection?
Those are really excellent questions, Joe, and let me preface my response by first thanking the listener for participating. We appreciate it, and it is vital. The safety of the vaccine is something that we really put first and foremost. It isn't possible to become infected by the vaccines that we use in our vaccine studies. What we've done is to use the most sophisticated techniques that we have available in terms of molecular biology, so that we only take bits and pieces of the virus. And even when we do that, we often modify the genetic sequence so that it doesn't even resemble a normal virus. So they're very distant and they really can't give rise to HIV. Similarly, we would never dream of doing what we might do in other diseases like influenza, where occasionally in some trials people are challenged with the virus. We don't do that in these trials. What we do is we vaccinate people. We vaccinate large numbers of people, and then if someone naturally comes into contact with the virus, that's when they're at risk. It's from their own natural behavior, not from the vaccine that we deliver.
Dr. Nabel, I need to interrupt you one moment to remind people that I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Sorry, you were saying you don't challenge them, and what was the other bit? You don't...
And the virus is, the vaccine is engineered so that it just can't give rise to the virus. So I think that those are the critical issues. A tremendous amount of preclinical testing is done to ensure their safety. And your listener is absolutely right that you cannot get infected from the vaccine.
Okay, Sally, thanks very much for that call. I just wonder, though, you know, it does remind me that the one of the early polio vaccines, of course, was an attenuated virus, and there was some talk, at least originally, about trying to, you know, knock out or knock down or weaken the AIDS virus so that you could then use it as a vaccine. Whatever happened to that?
Well, that's a good example, Joe, where early in the field, particularly in some of the monkey studies, there was some good evidence that an attenuated HIV vaccine could protect against infection in some aggressive monkey models. And although that was certainly an area that was explored with great intensity, it turned out that there were variants of virus that could break through in those models that could cause disease, and so no live attenuated vaccine vectors are being tested at this time, and I don't anticipate that that will ever happen, given what we know and what we can do with other tools.
We've only got a few seconds left, but I want to give you an opportunity to be optimistic. Do you think we'll come up with a vaccine?
Well, I wouldn't do what I do every day if I didn't believe that it was possible. I think that the virus is a wily virus. We have challenges in front of us. On the other hand, we have tremendously powerful new technology involving gene delivery, altered vector delivery. We have tremendous power in our ability now to look at immune responses. And I really do think that we've entered a new age in terms of vaccine development in general. And more specifically, I think we have a number of very promising approaches for HIV. It will take time, and it will require people to step forward, to participate. It will require the effort of the scientific community to put everything we can into understanding the scientific hurdles to making a vaccine successful. But I am optimistic that by pulling together from the scientific side, from the medical side, from the biotechnology side, and from the volunteer side, that we can make real progress in ways that weren't really possible even 5 years ago.
Okay, thank you very much. Gary Nabel is director of the Vaccine Research Center at the NIH. When we come back, a look at treating drug-resistant leukemia. Stay with us.